Welcome back. Thanks again to Ben Schneider. I mentioned that the Lord Huron album Long Lost comes out in May, but you can already pre-order it. And that streaming series is also available. Episode 4 coming up in a few weeks. We move on now. That was Cream, Tales of Brave Ulysses. And like Ulysses himself, our next guests have been on an arduous quest. You know, those of you who are interested in Bigfoot, Sasquatch, the Yeti, skunk apes, if you're of a belief that these are creatures, undiscovered primates of some kind, undiscovered flesh and blood animals living out there in the forests or mountains or wilderness areas, our next guests might throw some cold water on that. They have pulled together a massive pile of reports, incidents, encounters, evidence about the history of Bigfoot, in particular, the overlapping tales of assorted weirdness, paranormal mix and match, if you will, situations that are very likely uncomfortable for the traditional center of Bigfoot research. Josh Cutchin and Tim Renner, Where the Footprints End, High Strangeness Volume 2 is their new book, The Evidence. We'll pick that up right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Joshua Cutchin is a native of North Carolina with a long interest in Fortiana. He holds a master's degree in music literature and a master's in journalism from the University of Georgia, works as a public affairs specialist in the Southeast. In addition to his media work, he's a published composer and performs as a jazz and rock tuba player, having appeared on 8 albums and live concert DVDs. Timothy Renner is an illustrator, author, and folk musician. His illustrations have appeared in various books, magazines, fanzines, and comics, as well as on record and CD covers. Since 1995, he's been making music with his band Stone Breath. Timothy is the creator of Strange Familiars, a podcast concerning the paranormal, weird history, folklore, and the occult. We're here to talk about the follow-up book, Volume 2, Where the Footprints End. Josh and Tim, great to have you back.
It's absolutely great to be here. It's always a pleasure to speak to you, George.
Yeah, it's fantastic to be on Coast to Coast. Thanks for having us.
Well, I finished your book today. It's, you know, as much as I like the other one, the first volume one, this is really terrific. I mean, there's so much work that went into this. I can't imagine any other resource that has drawn together, has thrown such a wide net and pulled together so many different facts. But start with this. Josh, give me sort of the overview of what this book does. What it says to those who still believe that Bigfoot is a flesh and blood undiscovered ape out there.
Well, I think a lot of what this one does is, so we separated volumes 1 and 2 pretty arbitrarily. Volume 1 is folklore, volume 2 is evidence. It's a bit of a misnomer. There's plenty of evidence in volume 1 and plenty of folklore in volume 2. But I think that what this one does is really focus on the experiential details that a lot of people would like to sort of sweep under the rug. So we have a lot of things that are a lot more evidence-based. And we're looking at things that are like mystery lights, you know, UFOs, some of these absolutely uncanny vocalizations that happen, altered states of consciousness like mind speak, disappearing evidence, some of these different stick signs, and of course the way that these tracks just don't really seem to make a lot of sense sometimes with different toes and the way that they end abruptly. So I suppose what I really would hope that this does is position some of these quote-unquote weird Bigfoot aspects a little bit more centrally in terms of people's focus, because if we really want to understand what's going on, we have to accept aspects of testimony that even we're uncomfortable with, or aspects of testimony that might particularly not satisfy the sort of theory that's our own pet theory, in terms of just wanting to really be academically honest about it.
Tim, you guys make that point in the book, is that you say, look, you can't on one hand believe UFO or Bigfoot witnesses who tell us this story and then exclude certain parts of it because it doesn't fit your pet theory.
Yeah, it's not intellectually honest. You know, you can't just say they were crazy when they saw the UFO and they were sane when they saw the Bigfoot. It's just, you can't do it. What we have as far as Bigfoot, for the most part, we have some very, very nice, you know, casts of footprints and some other various evidence. But by far, most of what we have is witness testimony. And if you're going to start throwing out parts of witness testimony, you might as well throw out the whole testimony. You have to take the witness of what they say, or you're not being intellectually honest.
You know, I don't spend a lot of time at Bigfoot conferences or in that world, but I get the sense that maybe the Bigfoot folks are more dug in their heels in terms of the camps that they find themselves in, or at least it used to be that way. This is flesh and blood, and that's the way I'm going to pursue it, and that's the way I see it. Am I wrong, or has it changed? Tim, you first.
It's there. there's a good measure of that for sure. The reception to this book has been really good, and it sort of says that maybe the community in general was opening up to this sort of thing. Maybe they were ready for it. I've been saying I think this book probably should have been written 20 years ago, but not necessarily by us, but by anyone 20 years ago looking at these kind of weird things. Yeah, I mean, there's some hardliners that kind of want to dig in and really stick to that flesh and blood hypothesis. And this is probably still the majority of folks, but in general, I think that the reception has been a lot better than we thought. We thought we were going to really meet with some pretty hard resistance.
Josh, I would think that for academics, we don't have to name them here. You name them in the book. Academics who have stuck their necks out and put their reputations on the line to vigorously pursue Bigfoot and those stories and evidence, who would frame it as, they have to frame it as a flesh and blood creature, because when you bring all the other stuff into it, for them, it would really be risky for them. It gets really, truly weird.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I have, there's almost a heartbreaking aspect to this, because these Bigfoot footprints have been studied by some really well-intentioned, honest people, and they've brought forth some aspects of evidence that I think you'd be foolish to say aren't really supportive of something that would be like, a large flesh and blood creature, a large flesh and blood primate. We're looking at some stuff like, mid-tarsal breaks and dermal ridges, things that would be difficult to hoax and which are, again, really strongly evident of a primate. But we also have this other stuff that sits alongside of it. As Tim said, there's this aspect to being honest with witness testimony where you really do have to engage every aspect of what they're saying. It's not that you can say, oh, well, the Bigfoot disappeared. That must mean that it just jumped behind a tree or that it jumped into a ditch. Because if you use that logic, you can keep on walking back every aspect of witness testimony until you just say, well, they just saw a bear. So I think you really have to sort of engage with some of these details, and you have to sort of look at this question in ways I think that the UFO community has been a little bit better at looking at recently. I'm thinking of some of the things that Jacques Vallée has said about how, UFOs really have been sort of challenging this physical dualism that a lot of us are stuck in, this paradigm of something being only physical or only mental. And if you look at a lot of different traditions around the world, including, ghost hunting traditions, that's never really been the case. There have been these things that have been able to pass between worlds, non-physical things that can leave physical attributes or non-physical things that can even appear physical. So I think that's a really important thing to remember. But, yeah, there are these footprints that are absolutely great, and some of them do things that they shouldn't do.
Right.
They're a physical creature. So we really are in sort of a conundrum. And, maybe that's the point, is to sort of force us into this new way of thinking about these things non-dualistically.
Yeah, I would think people should be willing to cut some slack for the academics who have stuck their necks out to pursue this. If they want to stick to the footprints and search for physical evidence, fine, because they have helped move the ball down the field for folks in that field. Tim, let's jump into right into the evidence that you guys explore, looking at Bigfoot eyes. So a lot of stories that casual readers like myself have heard over the years about Bigfoot with glowing eyes, red eyes, different colored eyes, even light shining out of their eyes. And you think, well, that's a reflection of a flashlight in their eyes. That's a campfire. There's all kinds of explanations that might work. But as you guys explore, they don't. In many cases, they do not. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so if you're driving down the road and your headlights hit a deer and the deer's eyes light up, that's from what is called a tapetum lucidum. That's a reflective layer that a lot of nocturnal animals have in their eyes. And a lot of the flesh and blood Bigfoot folks have used that over the years to explain these glowing eyes. Say, oh, it's just eye shine. Eye shine being the reflective, light off the eyes. And they have a tapetum lucidum because they're, primarily nocturnal creatures. This sounds great. This sounds like it explains that, except that if you think of Bigfoot as a natural creature, they have to be either a hominid or a great ape, presumably. That would make them, part of the great ape order, and that would make them the only hominid or great ape that has a tapetum lucidum. Some sort of low-order monkeys like lemurs have tapetum lucidum, but no great apes do. No gorillas don't, orangutans don't, chimpanzees and humans don't have this reflective layer. So it would be, make them very unusual and unique among the hominids or great apes to have that feature. And the fact remains that, you know, despite that, a lot of witnesses insist that there was no light source reflecting that. These eyes were glowing. And, you know, we come back again to this sort of witness testimony where you could say, oh, they didn't know what they were looking at. And, you know, there must have been some kind of light reflecting out of their eyes. And again, I think we're back to that same problem where we're not trusting the witness. We're sort of saying, well, they were right about seeing the creature, but not right about the light sources. I've talked to witnesses that have seen their eyes change colors. Like they said they were like Christmas lights. They were blinking and changing colors. You know, this is not something that normal animals do. In fact, there's no animal that has glowing eyes at all. I mean, where you can find glowing eyes is in folklore. There are folklore creatures from all over the world that have glowing eyes, but no natural animals have glowing eyes.
Especially not red glowing eyes or green glowing eyes. You've got a lot of examples in here. Can you want to share some of the ones that you list in the first chapter?
Oh, sure. I'll have to look them up here. There are red eyes, there are green eyes, there are yellow eyes. It's let's see. There was I have stories going back to the 1800s where people reported creatures with fiery eyes. The earliest one I have in the book is 1857 from Oregon. A wild man abducted a youth, and the youth described him as a man about 12 or 15 feet high, of athletic proportions, with glaring eyes that had the appearance of liquid balls of fire. Just moving forward into like 1911 in Pennsylvania, the town of Russell was haunted by an unknown monster. That was tall, someone like a man with fiery eyes. There was reports on into the 70s, also out Pennsylvania, with different eyes. One of my favorite was this creature known as Fluorescent Freddy from French Lick in Indiana. And he had orange or red glowing eyes, depending on the report. So there's all different colors, and there's, you know, all different, these reports from all, you know, time and all over the world, really. So they're just, you know, it's amazing the amount of different reports they have, but no shortage of them. With all this weird stuff, there's really no shortage of reports.
And also in this chapter, Josh, I suspect this might be some of your handiwork, are references in folklore going way, way back in literature, like Beowulf, stories of big monster-type creatures with glowing eyes.
Well, you know, there's no shortage of folklore knowledge for Tim either. So that's Tim's. But you know, so much of what we did was looking at each other's work and saying, "Oh, I know this other one other thing," and you know, trading it back and forth. So yeah, there's a little bit of that in both instances. Yeah, for sure.
You have a lot of these stories and encounters that you give a recap of what the witness saw. Yeah, I'm watching TV and there's a creature outside my window and he's got red glowing eyes. And then I picked up my gun and shot it. As there's a lot that becomes the end line to a lot of these encounter stories, is just how many people grab a gun and shoot it.
Yeah, I think we might have discussed this a little bit last time too. Yeah. But it's always interesting to me when you know, Bigfoot will either, you know, literally disappear when people shoot it, or will completely not react. And, you know, people have had different ideas through the years. They've been like, oh, there's a large subdermal fat layer, like with a grizzly bear, or, oh, they have really thick skin. But, you know, in all my research, the things that I discovered were, you know, number one, even grizzly bears will react when hit with high-powered rifles, and that doesn't happen in some of these Bigfoot cases. You know, to say nothing of the fact, you know, I've seen footage of a grizzly bear doing a complete 180 after being hit with bird shot. So that doesn't seem a strong a possibility. And then the other thing is that in primates, the more hair covering there is, generally speaking, as a rule, the thinner the skin is. There have been some primate dermatologists that have done studies on this. So the idea of a primate having especially thick skin doesn't seem to really correspond. What it really does correspond to is, you know, all these different bulletproof entities that we find throughout folklore time and again, as well as that, you know, that trope of basically the Death Star trope, right? The idea that there's one spot on this creature that you can hit that'll wound it. That's something that comes up time and again in a lot of this different literature as well.
You quote John Keel, Fortean researcher, author, who noted that glowing eyes separates the natural from the unnatural. He believes self-luminous eyes suggest a paraphysical entity rather than a real animal. Is John Keel sort of your patron saint, a guiding saint?
He's definitely one of them. I love John Keel. I love that his way of thinking about this was sort of holistic and open-minded, and I think he changed over his life, which I think is important. The more you're into this, the more you kind of adjust your way of thinking, because it's probably dangerous to get stuck in one rut. We don't really know the answers to any of this, so he kind of kept open to all that. And the other thing John Keel did, which I like to do, is he threw himself in the middle of it. Like with Mothman prophecies, he just threw himself right in the middle of that investigation, and that's certainly my approach. I tend to just throw myself in and see what happens to me too, as well as the witness.
You have cases of not only the glowing eyes, eyes changing colors and glowing, but also eyes emanating sort of a beam and then spectral lights in association with these Bigfoot encounters. Tim, why don't you start on that, and then we'll get Josh's take on it.
Yeah, there, you know, these other weird lights, like associated with them, I have one, I just didn't know what to call them. There's these, like, and these are aside from the orbs, which are, you know, a whole other thing associated with the creatures. It's just very, very common for people to see orbs of light. But I have stories of, like, in spring of 1975, a woman in Puerto Rico saw a creature kind of morph into and shrink into an actual kind of glowing orb. There's another story of a man, speaking of shooting a Bigfoot, he shot one, and from the wound was a blue glowing light issued from the wound after he shot it. And so there's all manner of these other weird lights associated with some of the creatures. Sometimes these old reports will say they had, you know, fire coming out of their mouth and nose. You know, again, the orbs are very common, including, you know, creatures holding orbs. There's some reports of them. So it's just these weird lights seem to just kind of haunt this phenomenon. You know, they won't leave Bigfoot alone between the UFOs and the other strange lights.
And then you have Bigfoot carrying what look like lanterns, which sort of dovetails with old folklorish type tales, right, Josh?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, the idea of spectral lights just is one of those constants throughout all sorts of phenomena, to the extent that it kind of makes me wonder if that's not the purest form of these things that we see, you know, and everything else that we see, Bigfoot, ghosts, the fairy folk, and even UFOs, if sometimes those aren't just skins that these things wear. But, you know, absolutely, and that trope of you know, the guy with the lantern moving along a coastline or moving along a railroad is something right out of folklore as well. I think it's off the coast of where is it, Maryland, Tim, or was it New Jersey? There's some place that actually has a
Rhode Island.
That's right. Thank you. there's actually a Bigfoot off the coast of Rhode Island that supposedly goes through the dead of night with these this lantern that swings to and fro, and it murmurs itself as well. And that really dovetails with a lot of these, you know, will-o'-the-wisp stories, to the extent that some people even said, oh, it's a wild man and a will-o'-the-wisp, as opposed to a wild man carrying a lantern.
Here's the story about the guy who shot one and the blue light comes out of the bullet hole. It's September 1985, Shenandoah, Virginia. Guy is fishing and he sees a 7-foot Bigfoot running along the bank, moving faster than any animal the witness had ever seen. So the fisherman, of course, picks up a gun and shoots at it, hits it in the chest. Bigfoot stops, stares at the witness, a blue light shining from the bullet wound. Terrified witness flees the scene. I mean, there you are fishing. You see this amazing thing. Oh, yeah, need to shoot that one.
Well, I mean, it happens. My friend Wes Grimmer from Sasquatch Chronicles podcast, he says very astutely, I think, that when people are scared, if they have a gun, they're probably going to shoot.
I tell you what, we got to take a break. Talking with Josh Cutchin, Tim Renner about Where the Footprints End, High Strangeness, Volume 2. We'll be right back. We're talking with Joshua Cutchin and Tim Renner who have pulled together an exhaustively thorough research project about Bigfoot. And each point they raise in their new book, Where the Footprints End, Volume 2, has 8, 9, 10 or more cases, incidents, reports of encounters with Sasquatch where various paranormal phenomena are observed in addition to the beast itself. And these stories get pretty weird. Turns out Bigfoot is a talented mimic, has been known to mimic bird voices, dogs, wolves, and people. We'll hear some of those stories when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM. One of the issues raised in the early part of your book is about the green flash phenomena, and you tell a story about Greg and Dana Newkirk, paranormal investigators who also have a traveling museum of the paranormal and the occult. Which of you can share that story?
I think probably either one of us, but it was in my chapter about the weird lights. And this green flash, it just seems to appear in these various cases. And again, this is something that's kind of across the board paranormal. But Greg and Dana weren't, specifically Bigfoot hunters. They became interested in the phenomenon. And they hooked up with these two guys named Dallas Gilbert and Wayne Burton, who had a place they went to they called the Boneyard, where they had multiple encounters with Bigfoot creatures, both of, what they call Class B encounters, where you hear something or have something thrown at you or something and don't see it, and Class A encounters, where they had, sightings of the creatures and some interaction with them. And strangely enough, they taught Dana this, chant. They said that would summon Bigfoot, that would call Bigfoot. That it sounds bizarre, but that's what they did. And she learned it and did this chant. And shortly after they did it, it started with a green flash, they said. And then they had encounters all night. They had creatures approach them. They said they could hear them. I don't think they saw one, but they had booming shrieks, they said, from the woods. And they said, according to Greg, he said, frankly, I was terrified. This is a quote. We all were. None of us had heard anything like this before. Howls continued for 2 hours, they said. They got stones thrown into the camp. On one occasion, something charged from the tree line, which caused Burton to stand up. He leapt from his chair and ran at it and apparently, backed it off. But Greg later went back into his records. He'd been doing paranormal research for a while. And again, this is a quote from Greg. He said, the more I dug into the green flash phenomenon, the more interesting things got. These mysterious lights popped up in loads of reports connected to everything from ghost sightings to UFO experiences to, believe it or not, Bigfoot. Most often the green flash was reported as an afterthought, as if the primary phenomenon experienced by witnesses was so stunning that the flash was nearly forgotten. So he went through his file and he found other examples of them. So it's just one of these weird things that kind of people put to the side, but it's something that, when we're talking about lights and Bigfoot, it's definitely something I wanted to cover.
Like it could be a side effect of whatever mechanism they're using to move around? Or, I mean, what's your guess?
I mean, that's the thought with all of this stuff is, maybe some of these banging sounds and some of these metallic sounds that people hear is perhaps them coming and going from wherever they come and go for. I mean, this is speculation. We really don't know, but it's a fun theory. And I think the green flash seems like a similar thing, like a side effect of however they come here and go away. And again, I don't know. The sad thing is that we don't have any real answers as to what Bigfoot is. We just know it's weird.
Josh, the last time you were here, you and I had a conversation about Bigfoot overlapping with UFOs. And of course, this drives both Bigfoot and UFO people crazy because they hate each other. The UFO people don't like cases where UFOs are seen in connection with Bigfoot, and the Bigfoot people are hated just as much, and they both of those groups probably hate the ghost hunters as much. But you have to follow the evidence where it leads, and in this book you have a heck of a lot of cases where Bigfoot is seen in and around UFOs. Can you share just some general stories and then maybe some specific examples?
Well, yeah, and the irony is that for the rest of the world we all look like the crazies.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
that's the funny thing. Yeah, you can draw some pretty strong parallels, not only in terms of eyewitness sightings, but just in terms of, generalized sightings and the states and with which the most UFOs are seen tend to also be the states that the most Bigfoot are seen. But there are some examples of people who do see beings, you know, in close proximity to UFOs. So volume one, we talk about, you know, Bigfoot that are seen as part of like the alien contact experience. And volume two, just because there's so much data about Bigfoot and UFOs, we had to split it somewhere. So volume one is sort of the alien abduction experience in Bigfoot, and volume two is wherever there's, you know, a Bigfoot seen outside of a structured craft, because we wanted to have that really close to these stories where people see lights, because, you know, a UFO can become or come from a light, you know, in terms of the way that people start out their sightings. But yeah, there are just a ton of different stories that you find, and they're not really that hard to find at all. One of my favorite stories happened in the late 1960s. There was a young man by the name of George Kaiser who was in Indiana, and he was actually walking through across the barnyard of his parents' farm, and he saw this about 5'8" tall creature about 25 yards away that was really muscular, and it was entirely covered in black hair except for the hands and its face. And he's standing there, and they're looking at each other and just sort of frozen. And eventually the creature grunts, turns, and runs away. But two oddities that are associated with that one are that it left these four-toed tracks in its trackway. And also the next night, there was a greenish-white glowing light that was going across one of the, not only across the sky, but I believe also across a ridgeline that led to rolling blackouts in the area. So you do see these, you know, time and time again. There's another sort of from the same time period that I think is really indicative of some of the stuff that's going on is some of the sightings that came out of the Yakima Reservation in Washington State. There are plenty of different Bigfoot reportings from there, but also, you know, these sort of cigar-shaped UFOs, rocket-like aircraft, and sort of like flint jets of fire across the sky that people would see. But in addition to all this, they also were noticing these, you know, sounds of something going on underground, these machine-like sounds underground, and these, you know, screams of these, like, children or babies in the night. So you have sort of all these things coming together in this sort of, for lack of a better term, paranormal soup that I just find to be some of the most interesting cases ever.
Yeah, you cited in that point about Yakima, this guy named Bill Vogel, fire control officer at the Yakima Reservation, and he had been keeping sort of a log of all the strange activity, and very much reminiscent of Skinwalker Ranch, which we talked about the last time, but this is detail. I don't remember ever seeing that name of this him, he and his report. I'll have to look that stuff up. It sounds like it's loaded with info.
Yeah, I feel like any single case in this, you could probably turn into its own longitudinal, you know, case study, long-term book. I oftentimes, when talking to Tim about this, was saying that it was like drinking through a hose, because I think that whenever people read these books, I think I want that to be one of their takeaways, is that strange things happening with Bigfoot are not uncommon. We could have picked, you know, another 10 cases for any one of these subject areas. I think we were as thorough as we could be without losing our minds, but we could have been more thorough still. And I feel like if you look at the people who are having these long-term experiences with creatures, so not people who are, you know, hunters seeing one walk by, or people who are traveling down a road and see one cross the road, but people who have these long-term experiences, the stranger they get. And it really is a lot like the UFO phenomenon in that respect. You know, people might see some anomalous lights in the sky and you know, think that the extraterrestrial hypothesis is the way to go. But a lot of times when you talk to these experiencers who have long-term experiences with these things over the course of several years, that's when all the weird stuff really starts to come out, the stuff about, you know, spiritual angles and, you know, past lives and stuff like that as well. And you find that with people who are Bigfoot habituators. The longer people spend around these creatures, the stranger things tend to get, honestly.
Yeah, there are places around the country, and you mentioned a couple of them, where the long-term residents see them on an ongoing basis over years and years, some of whom I think have probably developed relationships, a give and take, and, you know, learn how to get along kind of a situation. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. as true as your own, you know, credulity will let you stretch.
Right.
You know, I do have a problem when people come back and say that they've, you know, spent, you know, three decades on their property with Bigfoot and they don't have any good film of it.
Right.
But I also am sympathetic to the fact that I think that these phenomena can sometimes, you know, mess with cameras and mess with, you know, the ability to actually get solid visual evidence. But, you know, a good example of that was a lady by the name of, Jane Carter Coy, I think was her name, who was in Kentucky and claimed that she had these long-term experiences with Bigfoot, and even to the extent that Bigfoot one time came into her house and she gave him some food inside her house at the screen door. So yeah, you know, I don't know what to make of that, but it does tend to be the people who are like, yeah, I have these things on my property all the time, and I also see the lights. You know, yeah, I have these things on my property all the time, and I also have poltergeist phenomena happening inside. Tim spoke to somebody on his show, Strange Familiars, that actually seen some Bigfoot-like creatures in his house, and actually ended up having a footprint manifest in the carpet of his floor.
Wow.
Just a single giant footprint manifest, which is just really strange.
Tim, you guys have a subchapter about a place called the Bell Farm, which had multiple experiences or reports of Bigfoot sightings in connection with UFO activity. Can you share some of that?
Yeah, so that was located in Derry Township in Pennsylvania, and that was taken from, it was really like a flap of UFO and Bigfoot sightings that were happening in Pennsylvania in around 1973, 1974. And this was one of them. So Mrs. Bell first saw a dark figure that stood upright, just about 10 feet away. It was hairy. It raised its long arms at her, and she cried out in fear. And the creature returned the cry as if it was mimicking her. She cried out, she screamed out even louder, and then it answered her cries again. And they sent, Stan Gordon was the guy that was kind of handling the investigations of this and in Western Pennsylvania at the time. And he had a team of investigators. He or one of them went out and you know, started investigating. And as other people in the area had said, they'd seen creatures. Mr. Bell, her husband, and another man had actually searched for the creatures in the surrounding fields, but instead of finding the creatures, they found a UFO. They said it was a large, luminous, tube-shaped object just hovering over the hills behind the farm. Its red glow was bright enough to illuminate the ground. Mrs. Bell said, she's like, I don't know if it has anything to do with this thing, the creature, but every time we see it or hear it, that light is pretty close. So the Bells, along with other people in their area, reported a bright star-like object that would regularly appear in the sky around 10 p.m. The light appeared larger than a star or a planet and alternated between silver, red, and black. So here we have something that changes colors. And, the investigator sent out was named Barry Clark, I guess. And he had observed the UFO in September of 1973. Before seeing it earlier in the evening, he heard something which he presumed to be Bigfoot. He said, I actually got to hear the thing scream. It was an earth-shattering, scary scream. It started out as very deep and rattling, and then turned into an awful howl, like a howl and a growl at the same time. Later, he watched this bright light in the sky change colors, and he drove to a nearby hilltop. He met others there who had seen the light, and they were kind of observing it, and it issued flashes about a second apart, which lit up the sky in descending rings of deep red, and subsequently the sky was littered with small silver lights gravitating towards a larger light, which had itself turned red. And the silver lights became red as they approached a larger light. So this is a strange, weird light display they're watching. And this guy, Clark, he'd had enough. That was the end of his investigating Bigfoot and UFOs. Whatever that experience was, turned him off. He was done with it.
Josh, you guys make the point that in a lot of cases, people who have really academics and others who have written very thoughtfully on these subjects, on the subject of UFOs, you can almost substitute Bigfoot for UFOs and it still works. Carl Jung is an example where he's writing about UFOs and you quote him as talking about them being physical at times, but also psychic. And that sort of is what you're saying about Bigfoot.
Yeah, Tim actually came up with a great analogy for this that I was surprised no one had come up with before, which was that of the Mobius strip. If I could sort of put that over to Tim, because it was so insightful, I thought it was a really cool way of explaining how you can think about these things in terms of being both, you know, physical and non-physical.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest problem, and I still have a hard problem with this, because we talk about these things as being sort of apparitional, and I think when someone hears that, they think we're saying, like, either Bigfoot isn't real or they're just like a ghost, and it's not, and it's a really hard concept to grasp that these things can be physical and non-physical at once. And I don't know how it came to me, but I just thought of this idea of the Mobius strip, which is a strip of paper that you twist. You kind of make a loop in it, but you twist the loop before you close the loop, so it kind of has a twist. And if you write on one side of that, you know, just do an experiment, write apparitional or non-physical or whatever on one side and write physical on the other, and you run your finger along, you'll find that you will cross all the way through the apparitional side to the physical side and back to the apparitional side all at once, you know, if you follow the path of that strip. So basically, that's my way of sort of trying to visualize this idea that things can be kind of both at once, because really I didn't want people to think I was saying they weren't real. I believe the witnesses. I believe these things are real, and I believe they certainly can be physical. They leave evidence behind. They leave footprints behind. They leave hair behind. Sometimes they leave, you know, blood and scat behind. But they seem to be here and not here at once, and that is the conundrum, and that's the problem. So the kind of Mobius strip idea is the way I came up for myself to visualize it.
Well, as you guys point out, I mean, you know, if people want to argue, is Bigfoot real? It kind of depends on what you mean by reality, and that's really not as firmly established as maybe we'd like to believe. You know, reality, our idea of reality is changing, and this may be a way to reinforce the idea that we don't exactly know what's going on. You say at the end of this chapter, you write, Bigfoot and UFOs appear together, not rarely, not occasionally. They appear together often. The connection between the two is downright weird and defies explanation, just like Bigfoot. And the fact is, you put all these cases together, you still don't know what they are, or where they're from, or why they're here. I mean, you could, Josh, you could jump to all kinds of conclusions, like ETs seeded the planet with Bigfoot, or Bigfoot is the hired muscle on the ground to protect the little spindly aliens, or take it wherever you want to go. But the fact is, we really don't know.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that Tim said to me a long time ago was, he said, you know, we don't have sightings of orangutans and UFOs, or gorillas and UFOs. You know, to see a Bigfoot is rare, and to see a UFO is rare, and to see them together, you'd think that rareness would be orders of magnitude greater, but it really doesn't seem to be the case. You know, I really would like to echo what Tim said in terms of, you know, what it is and how to think about these things. I think the best way to sort of think about these things is that people are seeing something and they are experiencing something, and that perception to a certain degree, as you alluded to, George, really does make reality. So much of what we're finding out with science, you know, in recent years has really underscored the fact that a lot of the way that we process information is not the way that reality really functions, to the extent that stuff in your peripheral vision right now is more of a ghost image of what you just saw than it's what you're actually seeing, you know, until something enters your field of vision and that edge detection kicks in.
Yeah.
So I think when you look at that and you look at things like some of the work that's been done with the work of Rick Strassman and the DMT studies and some of the things that we have to learn about altered states, I think it really, it upends a lot of our cosmologies that we've created around these things.
And we'll get into that, altered states. Yeah, we'll get into that, altered states, in a little bit. We're talking with Joshua Cutchin and Timothy Renner about Where the Footprints End, High Strangeness and the Bigfoot Phenomena, Volume 2, Evidence. A lot more still to cover. Bigfoot mimicry, maybe some cases of telepathy. This book is packed with information, and we're going to get to as much of it as we can.